Hello, everybody. Welcome to the TriStar Gym channel. Today, I am super happy to have as a guest, Mr. Michael Saylor, longstanding CEO of MicroStrategies. And in my opinion, the top influencer in the Bitcoin world today. Michael, welcome to the channel. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Are you? Do you watch MMA?
I saw you on Joe Rogan. I watched some MMA.
We got to get you on Joe Rogan soon. I got to have the fans. I want everybody to bombard Rogan, and I want you on the Rogan channel talk about Bitcoin, explaining to the world why Bitcoin is on fire. Michael, remind me real quick, how much have you invested in Bitcoin so far? Was it 3 million, 3.3 million? What was the number again?
I mean, all told, my company, MicroStrategy, has invested $3.16
billion. $3.1 billion.
Yeah, I put another $175 million of my own money. So I'm 3.3 something.
I love
3.35. I can't remember exactly.
I love it.
It's a lot of money.
A true Bitcoin whale out here in the open. It's amazing. So tell us, Michael, for the guys, there's a lot of people listening. They don't know much about Bitcoin. I'm a diehard Bitcoiner. I love Bitcoin. But for those who never heard about Bitcoin, why are you choosing to put your money in Bitcoin and not in the bank?
Let's start with first principles. You know, what is inflation? Inflation is when the government sucks the energy out of the currency. So if we go to an analogy that an athlete would understand, you run a dojo and the government sends you a note saying, I need all of your fighters to give me a pint of blood. So everybody donates a pint of blood. And to get ready for this, I Googled this and I found out that Google thinks it takes 4 to 8 weeks to replace your red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You got 10 pints of blood in your body. So if you get bled 10% of your blood, then I guess you're not going to be the ideal top athlete for 4 to 8 weeks.
That's true.
And so maybe, you know, if you had a big competition, you would not want to do that within 2 months of the competition, but you'd probably train a little bit weaker too. So that's about 10% inflation. Now, what happened if you got a memo from the government and they said, we need a pint of blood from every fighter every quarter, every 12 weeks? Now you've got to like 25, 30% inflation, and now you're never really on. Now, what happens if the government sends you a note saying, well, we're going to need a pint of blood every month? Okay, so inflation is currency collapse. And currency is to the economy what blood is to the body. And value or energy is oxygen. So I'm sucking the blood out of your body. I'm sucking the oxygen out of your body. If I keep sucking the oxygen out of the room, you can't perform. When the inflation is running, the government says it's running 2%. It's not running 2% because the measure of inflation is a manufactured one. If I just measure things that don't go up in price, then inflation is low. But if I measure things that you want, like housing is up 27% year over year. The stock market is up 27% year over year. So if you wanted to buy a house or if you wanted to buy a bunch of stocks, the inflation rate's 27%. The currency is losing 27% of its value. That is 27% of your blood getting pumped out of your body. Okay, so what we had was a low inflation environment, and it tripled in March of 2020. And we went from maybe, 7-8% consistent inflation in the US to now 24%. And we've been running north of 20% for the past 18 months. So now, a simple observation, right? You're an athlete. If I told you that everybody's bleeding, what's your first thing you're going to do?
Call the cup man.
Stop the bleeding.
Call the cup, man. You got to stop the blood.
Stop the bleeding.
You have to.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So the first observation is you got to stop the bleeding if you're an investor. And how do you stop the bleeding? Well, if you have all your money in a bank account and it's in US dollars, you're losing 15, 20, 25% of your value a year. But if it's in pesos in Argentina, you're losing like 40% of your value a year. And if it's in Venezuelan Bolivar, you're losing 95%, right? They're literally getting bled every week. It's like
could,
the government
the
shows
best,
up and says,
you could be the best investor in the game. You're still going to go out. You're still going to be out.
If you're in an economy with hyperinflation, it's the same as getting bled to death. And so in an economy like Venezuela or Nigeria, Zimbabwe, or most of Africa, that's a currency collapse, which is like you're on life support on a ventilator. Mm. There is no investment strategy or business strategy that will save you, right? You're in deep trouble. If you're in America or in the Western world, then your currency was getting weaker 6, 7, 8% a year, but now it's getting weaker 15, 20, 25% a year, depending. We can debate back and forth what the inflation rate, but the reason it's hard to pin down inflation is because if you want to sleep in your parents' basement and watch Netflix and order pizza, the inflation rate's not that high. Mm. If you want to rent a house, the inflation, or rent an apartment on your own, the inflation rate's higher. If you want to buy a house, the inflation rate is 25%. Mm-hmm. And if you want to buy other scarce assets, then the inflation rate is running sort of around the S&P 500 index. So if you want a surrogate for inflation, look at the rate at which a basket of 500 desirable stocks goes up in price. Mm-hmm. And that will tell you the rate at which the money supply is expanding. Or look at the rate at which housing, the Case-Shiller index went up 27% year over year, July to last July. It's running in that range in the last 4 months. That's the highest rate of housing price increase since 1987. So if you want to be rich, your inflation rate is the rate of the S&P 500. That's the cost mm-hmm. of capital, right? Mm-hmm. And what the government says is, well, our CPI is going to measure things, but it won't include energy. It won't include housing. It's not going to include food.
It's not accurate. Okay.
If you don't want housing, food, and energy, then yeah, there is no inflation. Mm. But in what universe are you not going to want housing, food, and energy?
Exactly. Your money doesn't go very far. It doesn't do much.
Okay. So the first observation is, you got to understand inflation. And if inflation is the cost of capital, and the cost of capital is like the rate at which the S&P index goes up, which is about 27%, well, for us, for 100 years, S&P went up 10% a year. So for 100 years, it felt like one third of what it is this last 18 months. So why did we get into this, into Bitcoin? Well, inflation is the rate you're bleeding. We have to stop the bleeding. We had a bunch of cash. We had a $500 million business growing 0% with $500 million in cash earning 0% interest. Mm-hmm. And the value of the money is falling at 15 to 20% a year, which means shareholder value is falling, mm-hmm. which means that, if you had all your life savings and you sat there and you lost 15 to 20% a year for a decade, everybody knows I can't just save all my money in a bank account yielding 0% interest and expect to put my kids through college mm-hmm. or retire on that. In a decade, your money would get cut in half two or three times in mm-hmm. value, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the strategy? You got to stop the bleeding. Now, what is stopping the bleeding economically? It means convert your currency into property that the government cannot debase. Mm-hmm. So, the Venezuelan government can print a million times more currency, but if you own a house, you've still got the house. They're not taking 1% of the house every week, right? Mm-hmm. So your question is, what property do you buy? Do I buy a building? Do I buy a house? Do I buy art? Do I buy gold? Do I buy commodities? Do I buy stocks? Do I buy ETFs? Do I buy crypto? Do I buy Bitcoin? What do I buy? Something. I got to buy something with my money. Mm-hmm. they tell stories about hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, and management consultants are taking all their money and they're buying like a bicycle, or buy soap, or mm-hmm. buy toilet paper. Buy, the toilet paper will hold its value more than the paper, than the currency will, because at least it's still something.
I heard that goat shit was worth more because it burns longer than the money that burns. They value the goat shit even higher.
I had money in Argentina, And the currency was collapsing. You know, it was like 1 peso to the dollar, then 3 pesos to the dollar, then 20 pesos to the dollar, then 40 pesos to the dollar. Now it's like 190 pesos to the dollar on the black market. Mm-hmm. And my lawyers and finance guys came into my office. They said, well, we got all this money. We got $1 million. They said, well, can we wire it out of the country? I said, no. I said, can we buy gold with it and carry the gold through the airport? No. I said, okay, well, can you just go buy a yacht and sail it to the Caribbean? Mm-hmm. They looked at me like I was out of my mind. But, you know, like a yacht, I mean, a boat is also property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Okay, so now why Bitcoin? Well, if you put your money in a boat, the maintenance cost is 10%. The boat mm-hmm. might sink. It's expensive. If I buy a house, I got to paint it. It might burn down. You know, there's leakage, there's property tax. It's expensive. It's expensive to maintain. If I buy gold, well, gold is losing 2% of its value a year because gold miners keep producing more gold. So in 30 years, your gold's worth half as much as it was, and then another half, then another half. So gold is gradually losing its value, but it's very hard to move around, and nobody wants to rent your gold. Mm-hmm. Okay, at least if you buy a building, someone might rent it. If you buy a car, someone might want to use it. You might want to charter a boat, but you can't charter your gold. That's why people like property, like buildings and houses. Like, I'm going to Airbnb a second house and I'm going to get some rental income. That's the positive. But the negative is I can't carry a house on my back when I leave the country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I have an Airbnb in Buenos Aires, I mean, only a small number of tourists want to use that. So I don't... I've got a house. Who will give me a loan against it? Only an Argentine bank. Who will run a rent the house? Only an Argentine tourist. And then who will want to buy the house? Only someone that wants to live in Argentina. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's property, but it's highly expensive to maintain. It can be impaired. It can be taxed. And I can't sell it to a Russian billionaire. So what's the best property? Gold? No, gold was property in the 19th century. A house, land, that's property in the 20th century. Crypto asset, that's property in the 21st century. Bitcoin is the apex crypto asset, the apex property of the human race. Why? It's the most secure network. It's the strongest brand. Everybody in the world knows mm-hmm. what it is. Mm-hmm. It's engineered to be the most energy efficient. Mm-hmm. You know, like Brazilian jiu-jitsu, mm-hmm. it's all mm-hmm. about energy efficiency. That's you're correct. In a system with someone else. And the issue is, how can you bring all of your energy to bear and set it up so that they can't bring their energy to bear? And you're thinking mm-hmm. about energy and leverage. Bitcoin is engineered to allow you to bring monetary energy and leverage it and to be most efficient. And so we bought Bitcoin because it was the dominant digital monetary network. And we swapped our cash, first $250 million into Bitcoin, and it went up. And then we did a Dutch auction where we offered to buy back the stock of our shareholders if they didn't like the idea, because maybe they wouldn't mm-hmm. like it.
That's right.
Well, we had $60 million tendered, but we had $175 million that we had after the Dutch auction, and we bought Bitcoin with that, and it went up again. And then our stock went up. And then we issued a convertible debt, about $650 million of it. And we bought Bitcoin with that, and that went up. And then
amazing.
Our stock went up again. And so we kept buying Bitcoin. And we bought $3.16 billion, but we issued $2.2 billion in debt at about 1.5% blended interest rate. So we used our public company. It's like, what I do for us. I mortgaged my company. Right. I mortgaged the future cash flows of the company in order to buy an asset that's going up in value.
You got me thinking about mortgaging my house right now.
Well, let's say you were sitting in Argentina and you ran a business. Mm-hmm. And I said to you, you know, for us, I think that the peso is going to lose 95% of its value over the next 10 years. And you have a business and you're making like $1 million a year, and the peso is mm-hmm. 1-to-1. If you keep working for pesos, you'll be making 1 million pesos, and that'll be worth 50,000.
Yeah,
it'll be worth 1/20th that much in 10 mm-hmm. years. And so you're gonna lose most of your money. But if you mm-hmm. turn around and if you were to sell equity in mm-hmm. the business and get paid $10 million, then you buy Bitcoin with it, or buy dollars with it. In 10 years, you'll have $10 million instead of $1 million or $500,000. And if you were to get debt, if you borrowed $1 million or $10 million against your business and you paid 5% interest, well, you pay the 5%, 500,000 pesos a year, you have $10 million, you buy dollars, and then 10 years from now, you're still paying 500,000 pesos a year, but your $10 million is worth $10 million and your and the rest of the business is worth 500,000 pesos or something, right? It's just, it's collapsed to be worth 500, but very this, small
this
amount.
Is,
like
this is predicated on the belief that Bitcoin is going to keep going up. It's going to keep increasing in value.
Yeah.
Now what, I believe it's going to increase in value, but what makes you so confident that Bitcoin is going to keep increasing?
I think the, first of all, the engineering. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, isn't there a right way to do something
absolutely.
Like in jiu-jitsu and a wrong
absolutely.
Way?
Right? Absolutely.
Like one way is 10 times harder than the
absolutely.
Other way.
Absolutely. Okay, so 100%.
Technique. So if you study, study the way Bitcoin is engineered, mm-hmm. it's engineered so as to organically spread, to decentralize. Okay. It's an open system. Anybody mm-hmm. can mine it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody can move it around. And because the protocol is open and permissionless, it encourages organic adoption. It encourages decentralization. And anybody can run their own node. Mm-hmm. So that the network is millions of miners and tens of thousands of validating nodes everywhere in the world. So what you want is, you know, what you want in your superhero is you want indestructible.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
If I'm indestructible, like if I'm immortal and mm-hmm. indestructible, then yeah. I can just pick up a machine gun and kill everybody. Like, and they can shoot back at me, but bullets bounce off me. I don't need laser beams. I don't need to be beautiful. I don't need to be the fastest. I just need to be unkillable in that case. So Bitcoin is indestructible. It's engineered to last forever and to be hard to break and hard to change. What don't you want? You don't want more than 21 million, right? There will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So you want to engineer something so that even like my company has $6.5 billion of Bitcoin right now. I can't change it. I don't even know how to start to try to change it. If I was sitting in the office of the president of the United States and he had the head of the FBI, the CIA, and the entire DOD, all of us together couldn't collude to change it. Don't mm-hmm. know how to. If someone held a gun to my head and said, change it or I blow your head off, I still can't change it. You want to build something which is so decentralized. It's like, let me give you a metaphor, right? I can either create a beautiful creature, a kangaroo, or a horse, or I can like release plankton or algae. Okay, Bitcoin is algae. I've released algae in the world. It's spread to the seven seas. Okay, the horse is beautiful. It's in front of me. You can ride the horse. But the point is, if I have a gun, I can shoot the horse in the head. How do you shoot plankton?
Mm-hmm. It's unkillable.
Okay, so why is it going to go up? Because we have released this creature in cyberspace, which is 21 million Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and nobody knows how to stop it or kill it. And no individual could accumulate the power to. Mm-hmm. And it is a Darwinian hyper-competitive creature. It is the mm-hmm. most competitive monetary network in the world because politicians want it. Bitcoin miners, right? If you have a Bitcoin miner, you can generate $120 million a year, you know, mm-hmm. off of like an exahash, okay? It's very lucrative. Mm-hmm. So what you have is all of these companies competing to get that money. And then the way they're competing is they negotiate with energy companies. So the energy companies want to be part of this. The engineering companies, the technology companies want to produce Bitcoin miners and be part of this. Mm-hmm. The investors want to invest in Bitcoin mining companies. They want to be part of this. The politicians, like the governor of Texas, the mayor of Miami, the mm-hmm. president of El Salvador, They want to be part of this, right? My volcano is going to be worth billions and billions of dollars. I want a piece of this, right? Yes. So you have all of these people everywhere in the world in this mad scramble to be part of the network.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all fighting to defend it. And when they, and the strongest ones, right, they get into the network and then they turn all of their energy to defend the network and to improve the network for everybody else. And they all have different incentives. For investors, the incentive is inflation hedge. And there's $500 trillion of money that's being currently debased. And so $500 trillion getting inflated at 10% a year is a $50 trillion problem. Okay. So that's MicroStrategy, Paul Tudor Jones, Stanley Druckenmiller, Bill Miller, all the traditional institutional investors. They're looking at this saying, Bitcoin is digital gold, but Bitcoin is up 130% a year for a decade and gold is up zero. Gold doesn't work. Bitcoin works. That's one one group of people. The second group of people are the technology people. Bitcoin's a technology imperative. You know, we're going to see 8 billion people with digital wallets on their Android and iPhone, and they're going to have digital currency and digital asset. And that means like a digital dollar and a digital and a Bitcoin. And that's spreading like wildfire, like 3 million people in El Salvador in 3 weeks.
So you
and that
you,
means
you believe in Metcalfe's law. You believe it's user squared. That's the value. I mean,
it's even more than Metcalfe's law.
It's more than
Metcalfe's law explains why Facebook and WhatsApp works, right?
Right.
Like once everybody's on WhatsApp or once everybody's on Facebook, you know, the network spreads, you know, but this is something stronger because Rupert Murdoch never showed up to Facebook with a billion friends. You see, like when this is Bitcoin is a bank in cyberspace, and so it's more like Newton's law. It's the law of gravitation, which says that when an asteroid or when a planet comes into your orbit and it's bigger than you, it sucks all the atmosphere and it boils your ocean, sucks the you know, the atmosphere off your planet. And you collapse into it, right? And then it starts, it's kind of like a black hole where it's sucking in the moon, the star, the sun, the satellite, the everything in its path. And if it was just Metcalfe's law, if it was just a simple social network, then everybody's equal. Like you got a certain number of friends, I got a certain number of friends, you know, you bring 50, I bring 50, you bring 100, I bring 100. On average, the average Facebook person brought like 150 friends or something. Mm-hmm. But in the world of money, like in the some planetary bodies are a billion times bigger. The sun is more important than the moon,
right?
To us.
Of course.
Jupiter is more important than Pluto
to
us. And you know, and if like Elon Musk, well, you know this, right? On Twitter, if Elon Musk tweets, he's more important than me.
Right.
And if Elon Musk buys Bitcoin, he's more important than you buying Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're talking about power and influence. And what is money? Money is energy. Money is just the apex energy of the human race. And so the sun is the most energetic thing in our solar system, and we all revolve around it, right? And so what I think is going on here is you're seeing energy flowing into a network. It's getting stronger. Now, coming back to like why I think it's going up forever, it's going up because it's an economic imperative to investors, all of them, all 500, like everybody with money on the planet has the same problem, right? You see, everybody's got the same problem because everything you're invested in is either a currency or it's a currency derivative, unless it's pure property. So if you have rental housing, that's a currency derivative. If you have a stock, a value stock that generates cash flows and is valued on cash flows, it's currency derivative, right? If you have cash, it's currency derivative. Anything related to cash or future cash flows is a currency derivative. And if the currency is losing 10% of its value a year, you have to discount the cash flows by 10% a year. So as the monetary base expands, right, the extreme example is like Zimbabwe again. When the money supply expands and hyperinflates, there is no investment strategy that works other than convert your money into a hard property and remove the property from the country. Mm-hmm. Like, get it out of there. Because if you convert it into property and you stay in the country, the government will eventually expropriate your property. They'll mm-hmm. tax it mm-hmm. or seize it. So,
correct.
So if you look at it from a financial or an economic point of view, it's an imperative, and it's just a question of whether or not it's life or death, like in Afghanistan, or whether it's just an important inflation hedge, like in the U.S. Right. That's the first piece. But the second piece is the technical imperative, because this is a big idea. Digital property, digital music,
mm-hmm.
right? Think about what happens when I turn music into digital music and I stream it on Amazon or Apple Music. Digital video, digital music, digital books, digital maps, digital retail, digital stores, right? That's mm-hmm. digital mm-hmm. transformation. That's what made Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google. That was how you made money as a tech investor mm-hmm. in the past decade. Okay, most people couldn't really get their head around digital stuff, but
mm-hmm.
a digital map is you take Rand McNally, you put it on a phone, you give it to 8 billion people, then you light up the roads with the traffic patterns, and then eventually the map tells you how to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to the extreme digital map, you've got Google Maps and Google, and it's worth like $100 billion. And mm-hmm. when it was like analog map, it was worth like $100 million. Mm-hmm. So the digital transformation of these things drove FANG stocks for a decade. Now I'm going to give you three new digital transformations. You know, gold becomes digital. Well, analog gold's worth $10 trillion, so digital gold must be worth $20 trillion. Property becomes digital. You know, so analog property is worth $100-200 trillion. But when I converted your hotel and your rental house to digital property, we're going to slurp all the monetary energy out of that. I can move the hotel digitally from here to Tokyo at the speed of light for free. Interesting. And then finally, energy becomes digital, pure energy. Okay. And this is a big idea, but bear with me. You have a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You take all your life savings, you buy a hotel. You've got 50 rooms in the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It's in what city you live in?
Montreal.
You're in Montreal. Yeah, Montreal. I've been to Montreal. I love Montreal.
Awesome.
Your hotel's in Montreal. Now your room night is, you sell room nights and you get 70% occupancy at the average rate in Montreal. Okay, that's a decent business, 10% margin. Now I dematerialize it and it's a virtual hotel. Now, the 30% of the room nights that that I can't book in Montreal, mm-hmm. I send them to San Francisco or New York, and now mm-hmm. I go to 100% occupancy. And then I think, wait a minute, they pay more for room nights in London and New York than Montreal, so I send them all to New York and London.
The world is your market, not your backyard, the world.
And now my room rate triples, and my occupancy goes to 100%. And then you go, wait a minute. Okay, now you've got digital property, but I'm gonna like twist it a little bit. Now I think, well, you know, people only sleep in the rooms 8-10 hours a day. So I've mm-hmm. got, I don't know, about half the time. I mean, 12 room hours a day I could rent out to somebody else. So now you go, instead of selling 365 room nights a year per room, you sell 750 room nights. Mm-hmm. And then you start selling the rooms by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to rent out room hours at the city in the world that will bid the highest for the room hours. And you see that what happens shortly is that your effective occupancy rate goes to 1,000% and your rates mm-hmm. quadruple. And instead of like getting a 10% margin on property, which is expensive to maintain, that you get taxed on in Montreal, you're now getting like 4,000% profit on property, which has a carrying cost of zero,
mm-hmm.
which is not getting taxed in Montreal. So now what is that? That's digital property, but really Einstein said matter can be energy and energy can be matter, right? There is no mm-hmm. destruction of energy and matter. I can take $1 billion and I can buy a building. And what if I convert the building back into $1 billion and put it in the bank? I mean, it's, what do you have? You have property as matter and you have money as energy. Mm-hmm. And when I get to the point where I can take your hotel and sell room minutes, what happens when I sell room minutes?
It's far more efficient, far superior.
I decompose it. I recompose it. There is no loss. Like, you can't do this in the physical world, but in the virtual world, it becomes almost pure energy creature. Now, what I've described in a way is sort of like the promise of decentralized finance or any kind of high speed, high frequency finance activity. But the point that I'm making here is it's not just a digital gold or inflation hedge. It's digital energy, which means it's destined to sit on Facebook or Apple or Amazon or Google or flow through every mobile phone on the planet. And that takes me to my last observation. It's a moral imperative, 8 billion people.
It's what?
There's 2 billion people. It's a moral imperative to 8 billion people, because there's billions of people that have no property and they have no property rights. Right. Like, if you're living in Africa and you have $500, well, how do you store it? If you buy the local currency, it's going to zero in 12 months. How do you buy $500 of a building in Montreal when you live in Africa?
Exactly.
How do you buy $500 of stock when you live in Africa?
This is huge. I mean,
you can't. So what do? You $500 of gold. How do you buy that? I mean, what do you do with the money, right? How do you avoid having it stolen from you or debased or degraded? So here, the biological metaphor I give you is, if you have no bank and if you have no property rights, it's like you're a type 1 diabetic. You know, a diabetic has no insulin, and you can eat all day long, but you can't create fat. If you have no fat, fat is an organic battery. And if you have fat, you can live 60 to 90 days without food. No fat, you starve to death. I mean, there's a reason to have it on your body.
The reserve.
So if you have no bank, and if you have no property rights, you can't store economic energy, which means in the week when you lose your job or when you don't hunt, you don't eat, and then you starve to death or your family starves. So what you've got is billions of people in abject property. If you want to give, if you want to give music or joy to 8 billion people, you need digital music. And if you want to give an education to 8 billion people, you need digital education.
Very true.
And if you want to give wealth to 8 billion people, you need digital property.
100%.
You just can't do it. You can't give the human race wealth, and you can't give them economic security unless you have a technology that allows you to let them buy $387 of property for zero cost, move it at the speed of light, and decompose it and recompose it and carry it on a $50 phone in their pocket. If you have that, you can give economic empowerment to the entire world. And it's a nice to have if you live in a rich city in North America, but it's a matter of life or death if you live in a hyperinflating economy. Afghanistan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, all of Africa. Do you know that there are 66 countries for us that have dollarized? What that means is, you know what it means to dollarize? I'm going to give you another metaphor.
They take the American dollar, correct?
It means that your currency collapsed.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I want, again, take your best fighter, take your best athlete, put them on life support on a ventilator and transfuse them with blood. That's what it means when you're dollarized. It's like you're on life support in a hospital because your own organic system won't live without being on life support. You've got 66 countries that don't have functioning currencies. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem is they can't buy the dollars because they don't have banks. So if I turn off your currency, and if you can only get dollars through a foreign bank, and you can't get a bank account, then you don't have property, or you don't, you can't store your life force's energy. And so it's a real humanitarian problem. So coming back to your question, why is Bitcoin going up? Bitcoin's going up because it's a solution to 8 billion people's problem, because people on the left want it, because people on the right want it, because the technologists need it, because it's so decentralized. It's a virus, you can't stop it. And it's an idea whose time has come. And lastly, You know, if you look at the history of the human race, you know, fire was harnessing chemical energy. You know, if you look at how the Romans beat everybody, you know, they didn't do it with hand-to-hand fighting. I mean, they did it with ballista and catapults and missile weapons. They would stand back and they would blast kinetic energy 400 to 800 right. meters away. If you trace through the history of mankind, fire, water, electricity, explosives, right? Jiu-jitsu. Why does Brazilian jiu-jitsu win? It's a more efficient system for combat, right?
Correct.
Bitcoin is more efficient than gold. It's more efficient than fiat money. It's more efficient than storing your money in an Airbnb rental apartment. It's just the most efficient energy system. And rational people everywhere in the world, they're looking at it saying, why wouldn't I want to store my money in a property that is the apex property of the human race? I talked to one guy in Istanbul today and I said, you know, if you have money in Istanbul, you can put it all into a second house. Maybe a tourist in Istanbul will want to rent it via Airbnb. Maybe someone in Istanbul will buy it from you. Maybe a bank in Istanbul will loan you money against it. But you're talking about 0.1% of the world being interested in your property.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put your money into Bitcoin, I want the Bitcoin. If you put your money in Bitcoin, no property tax, it'll last a million years, 1,000 mm-hmm. years. It's not going to decay. It doesn't get rained on. You can loan it to anybody in the world. Any bank in the world might give you a loan against it, right? So you can use it as collateral anywhere in the world. You can generate rent on it anywhere in the world. And in the day when you need to sell it, every wealthy person on earth is going to want it. Right. So that's why it's apex. And the question is, why is it going up? Because it's better than everything else, you know? And if you think there's something else that's better than that, yeah, then you buy that. But I have searched the world over. I considered 1,000 things. I can't find anything better.
Okay. Let me throw a thought experiment at you and you okay. can clarify everything you've said. I think if you follow me along here, imagine I were to paint your fence. Okay. Cause this is from John Locke. My background's in philosophy. One of the greatest, most respected thinkers in history is John Locke. He influenced the founding fathers. No doubt. The guy was a brilliant man. He says, look, you own your body and you own your labor. You're using the word energy. He used the word labor. If I go and I till a land, I build on that land. I farm on it. I make it livable. I build a nice little village. I own that village. We own that village. We put our time and energy in that village. And therefore, it's an extension of our body. And we own it. This is what he says. So, for instance, if you ask me, for us, paint my fence and I paint your fence. You pay me $100 to paint your fence. That $100 is the accounting for my labor. I don't own that fence now. You own that fence. You gave me $100. That $100 represents my labor, or how you put it, my energy. Now, if I were to take it in US currency versus Bitcoin, if I take $100 worth of Bitcoin or $100 worth of American currency, which one of these two will preserve my energy better and why?
The US currency is going to lose energy anywhere from 7% to 25% a year. It's right. Fiat or the US dollar is a battery that's draining at 20% mm-hmm. a year right now. Gold is a battery draining at 2 or 3% a year right now. Bitcoin is a battery that doesn't drain.
It's charging.
Doesn't drain. In fact, it's charging. It's been deflationary, amping up at 100%+ a year.
It's deflationary. Right?
When I give you the money, you have the option to convert the $100 into Bitcoin immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You could also go the other way and convert the $100 into pesos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you look at the last year, if you converted the $100 into the S&P, you'd be up 27%. If you bought a typical house, you'd be up 25%.
Mm-hmm.
If you bought Bitcoin, you'd be up like 400%. If you held it in dollars, you'd have $100, but the $100 wouldn't buy as much as they would have bought last year. So Bitcoin is a battery. I mean, you can think of these all assets are repositories to store energy or to store money. If you want to call it money, you want to call it energy, you want to call it work, right? They're all just different ways to store that energy over long periods of time. What's the worst one? Like the Venezuelan Bolivar, is the worst one, right? That's awful. Yeah. If you took the money and you bought electricity, pure electricity, if I give you $1 million of electricity and you put it in the best battery, you lose 2% a month. So pure electrical energy loses 24% a year. And if you wanted to move the electricity 100 miles on a line, well, you need the line mm-hmm. and you lose 6% of it, mm-hmm. right? So you can store your money in different things and they all decay. Look, you can buy sheep with it. You can buy hamburgers with it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you can buy packaged food with it. So some things last a long time, other things don't. But here's the really big problem for us. All these other things you can buy, like let's say, you know, you're coming back to John Locke. John Locke said, you spend an entire year and you build a house for me and I pay you a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so you take the money and you buy your own house. Well, you don't really own your own house. In the physical world, if you own a house or you own a herd of cattle or you earn a bunch of gold, those are all spoils of war. I can take them from you.
True.
Right. With violence.
True.
I can take your house. I can tax your house.
Very true.
Right. The problem with gold is I can just murder everybody and the gold's still there.
Might is right sometimes.
Okay. So if you look at the history of humanity, Bitcoiners are pretty passionate. We're, you know, there's very a lot true. Of religious conviction. You see our laser eyes on Twitter?
Yeah. Right? I know.
Well, here's the big idea. For the first time in 10,000 years, we have invented a form of digital property, a form of property that you can truly own that is not spoils of war. Mm-hmm. You cannot seize Bitcoin with violence. And so gold is war. If you study, you know, all through history, it always ends with, you know, the Romans or the whatever, sack the city, kill everybody and take the gold. Right? Nobody ever burns the gold. They always take the gold. It doesn't matter whether the people live. So I can take your gold. I can take your land. I can take your house. You have a company, you know, well, the government like in Cuba and Venezuela, they're going to expropriate your company. In Zimbabwe, you have a ranch. They take the ranch. So if you have anything in the physical domain,
mm-hmm.
I can take it. And if you disagree, I can still take it. And, you know, occasionally I might negotiate with you, but there's not really an incentive for anybody to negotiate. I might as well, I can either just take 10% of it by a tax or just take it all. On the other hand, if you own Bitcoin and I come to you and I say, give me all your Bitcoin and you have the private keys, you can just say no. Okay. If 100 people in your city have Bitcoin and I go and I grab one of them and I put them in jail and I say, give me your private keys. Well, maybe after 60 or 90 days of like roughing you up, you might give me the keys. But the other 99 people in the city, they're going to send their Bitcoin somewhere else or put it, you know, send it or transfer it or get it out of the country. And so violence is not going to get you more than 0.5% of the asset. And if we invaded a country, I could take mm-hmm, the oil mm-hmm. out of the ground. I could seize everything. That's you don't want to be too violent, right? Because you burn all the buildings and you burn the oil wells, you do some damage. But ultimately, there's a lot of stuff that still might be left, depending upon how difficult the war was. But if I invade a company, I'm not getting any of the Bitcoin. There's 100%. No point in going to war. Right?
I'm always telling my sons, don't let me die all of a sudden. I'll die with my keys and you'll never inherit the Bitcoin I have. You know, make sure when I walk, don't let me get hit by a bus. Make sure, guys, your dad lives a long and healthy life, long enough to hand you down my passphrase and my keys.
Isn't it interesting? Because it used to be the Egyptian pharaohs, they wanted to be buried with their gold, but you bury them with their gold and then the tomb raiders
all get looted.
Steal the gold.
Always right? Looted.
There's this phrase, you can't take it with you. That's true of everything on earth except Bitcoin.
You can leave it on the blockchain forever.
Yeah, I mean, you could, if you die with your keys, then you've made a contribution to all the other Bitcoiners.
Mm-hmm. So that's true.
You've made a humanitarian contribution to everybody that was in your tribe. And so that's sort of good. I think that here's the big idea. Bitcoin is property rights. It's technology to deliver property rights to 8 billion people for the first time in the history of the human race. And I mean, life, liberty, and property. That's what John Locke was all about, property rights. And people diminish property rights saying, well, they don't matter. Well, they sort of do, because if I can steal your life's work from you like that, what was your life worth? I mean, it's completely and utterly demoralizing, right? You've stolen someone's sovereignty and their freedom and their liberty. So property rights does matter. And then half the world doesn't have any hope of accumulating property, and the other half has property at risk. And Bitcoin is technology that gives you back a right to your own personal sovereignty and your own property.
Tell me about El Salvador. They just made it legal tender. El Salvador is the first country in history to now make Bitcoin its legal tender. I have one fighter that I train. His name is the Pride of El Salvador, Ivan Menjivar, the greatest fighter from El Salvador ever. When I told him about it, he didn't seem very excited. He's like, oh, I don't know why they're doing this. I was like, I think this is a brilliant move. I think it's a brilliant move for El Salvadorians. They all, 70% of them don't have bank accounts. They can easily, a family can easily access a cell phone and now have a bank account. And plus they're starting them all off with $30. If you download the wallet, you get $30. What do you think about this?
I think that the elephant in the room here is international remittances, international payments are really horrifically broken. For if you take out your phone, like I don't think I could send you $30 on an Apple phone. It won't cross Canada. Try to send $50 to someone in France or Italy or the UK. We're not at war with UK and Italy.
No.
Like, try to send money off of your Apple Pay or a typical bank account. Half the time, you're sending it inside your own country and they deny it. But if you lived in Montreal and you wanted to send money back to your mother in El Salvador, you can't do it easily and quickly. And so El Salvadorians have two problems. One, they're dollarized. They don't have a local currency, which means that two, they're at the mercy of the Western banking system, which means that two-thirds of them don't have a bank. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, there's no currency, use the dollar. It's another thing to say, use the dollar, but by the way, we're not giving you any.
That's right.
Okay, so they don't have a currency. So they don't have property rights. That means they can't, they, you know, if I want to rip your country back to the Stone Age for barter, I destroy the currency, right? It's like, I'll give you two burritos, you know, for a jujitsu lesson, right? It's like, great, but I have like 16 burritos getting cold in the front door right now. And by tomorrow morning, I'm eating burritos for breakfast and, you know, it's like, it's not the way that you want to live. So the significance of El Salvador is they adopted Bitcoin as a currency, but it's alongside the dollar. And the whole idea is the dollar is the currency, Bitcoin's the asset, and it's also the network that we use to move the money for free at the speed of light. So the real big revolution here is Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, which allows you to move Bitcoin at the speed of light for free. I can send you $30 for 1/20th of a penny.
Yep.
And I can send it anywhere in the world. So what they've done is they've made it possible for everybody in El Salvador, essentially for free, to have their own bank in their wallet. I would say all you got to do is have a $50 Android phone, but everybody's already got the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, just about everybody's already got a phone. So all I got to do is download a free application. And now you can send me money for free instantly. I think if you look at this from this El Salvador's point of view, they added 3 million people in 3 weeks, and that's more than got a bank account in 100 years.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's like light speed, and then they're going to cut probably $400 million a year of remittance cost. Not to mention the fact, so try to figure out how to send your mother $300 on a Saturday afternoon via Western Union to South America. So you can't do it.
It's like a typewriter versus a computer. They're working with typewriters. Now they're finally working with computers. The possibilities are endless. The technology is superior. I think it was a brilliant move. I think the only trouble they might face is the volatility right now.
Yeah, I think that Bitcoin as the asset has been volatile, especially because it's traded in offshore exchanges with leverage, cross-collateralized with other altcoins. So if you have $1 billion altcoin and it's got 5% float, you got $50 million in the float and you traded at 20x leverage on a Saturday afternoon, then you're going to get lots of volatility on the small coins. And then people cross collateralize that to buy some Bitcoin. So you've got this crazy, you know, crazy, highly levered crypto world, and it's driving a bit of volatility in the near term in Bitcoin. But what I would say to anybody is, you know, don't buy it for 10 minutes unless you'd hold it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, be a long-term thinker. If you've got a 4-year time horizon or more, you don't get worked up over minute by minute, exactly. Hour by hour, day by day. You shouldn't buy it. If you have expenses in the next 6 months, that's working capital. You put your money into US dollars if you can. Mm-hmm. That's better than the Bolivar, put in the strongest currency. But if you don't need the money and you want to give it to your kids or your kids' kids, or you want to, or you want it to appreciate for the long term, you put it in Bitcoin and you don't pay attention to the price fluctuation, because the only thing you're likely to do is make a mistake. The more you obsess over it, you might sell it and regret it. The richest man in the world, you know, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, they're not rich because they trade. They're rich because they couldn't sell. Like Jeff couldn't sell Amazon. He was stuck with it. If you'd sold it, it traded down 80% 5 times over 20 years. So the secret to actually accumulating wealth is buy high quality property, you know, grit your teeth, get through the volatility. The volatility is the price you pay to outperform the S&P 500 by a factor of 10.
That's right.
That's the price you pay.
I see it a lot as the Lilliput strategy. You know, the people who are not in Wall Street are getting together with this new technology and they're tying down this big giant. They're out competing this giant. And sooner or later, they have no choice but to jump ship. They all want to jump ship. They can't. They can't right now. They're not regulated. It's not regulated enough. It's frowned upon, or I don't know what other restrictions you are. I think you're the first CEO of a public company to jump in at this level. Am I right?
We were the first.
Yeah, you're the first.
Others have followed.
How many have followed, do you think, right now?
There's a lot of companies following. I mean, by the end of the year, we'll have at least a dozen publicly traded Bitcoin miners. I think there's 6 big ones right now, or 7 that they have Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And some like Marathon bought, they have hundreds of millions and they bought Bitcoin. Square bought Bitcoin. You know, amazing. Jack Dorsey's been a big advocate and a big visionary here. And not only did Square bought Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and they have a lot, they also sell Bitcoin through the Cash App. And that's been a very big success for them from a business point of view. And Twitter built Bitcoin and Lightning Tips.
That's right. Twitter. That's right.
And so you see it spreading there. You see, PayPal obviously as well. Tesla did it.
PayPal as well.
PayPal adopted it, Coinbase, right? And so I would say there are probably like 30 odd public entities that have Bitcoin now on their balance sheets or more. It will spread, but to be clear, you know, it's a little bit more challenging for public companies to own Bitcoin because the accounting treatment for it is as an indefinite intangible, which means nothing to consumers. But what it means if you're a public company is if I buy $5 billion of Bitcoin, and if it goes down 20% and then it goes up by a factor of 10, then my GAAP accounting treatment would be, I say I've got $4 billion in assets and I lost $1 billion in my operating company. Mm-hmm. That's what the GAAP accounting says. But what the actual situation would be you would have $50 billion in assets and you would have had a $40 billion investment gain. So you can only mark it down. You can't mark it up. And so the optics of it right now for people that are very concerned about their P&L and their GAAP financials, you know, is I want to be conservative on this. You wouldn't take a beautiful P&L and put a lot of Bitcoin on it because it would obscure the optics and the clarity of the P&L. And it's a little bit scary for a conventional CFO. There's a big movement underfoot to review that. If you look, 515 different companies and individuals wrote letters to the Financial Accounting Standards Board, FASB, and they said, you should review this. And we think fair value accounting is a better treatment for it. But, you know, there until then, like, I don't think Apple's going to buy $100 billion of Bitcoin if they can only write it down and they can't write it up. People will be more conservative on that, right? And you can look at that and say that's a negative, or you can look at that and say that's a positive because I can actually get in and buy Bitcoin before
they drive up the price.
So like from my point of view, I said, okay, well, it's inconvenient, but I'll just go and explain it to my shareholders. And now once they've understood it and we've rotated our shareholder base, now it's like you want to get down to the valley, you have to shoot the rapids. I went through the rapids. Now we're in the valley. Everybody else is afraid to go down the rapids. Mm-hmm. I get the valley to myself.
Beautiful.
Right? Also, you just got to figure out, you know, do you want to be really early, the first decade, right? There are guys that bought Bitcoin at $50 and it was brutal. Mm-hmm. Do you want to be the second decade, which kind of started March, April, May, like when my company bought it, we bought it in August. We announced it. We were the first company to buy any material amount. So we're kind of like in the second year. So you can come here, but if you wait until everybody agrees,
right,
then you're not getting 10x or 20x returns. You're going to get 5% returns because all the risk and all the uncertainty is gone. A lot of good things have happened for us in the past 3 months. Like Jerome Powell has said, it's an asset. We're not going to ban it.
Beautiful.
He's the head of the Fed. Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC, has said, you know, Satoshi's innovation is real. This is real. We're not going to ban cryptocurrency.
I heard.
They're going to regulate other stuff, but the regulation will mean like, okay, it's property. And if you want to sell it, you got to pay capital gains tax on it. But that's
amazing news.
That's okay. My advice to everybody is don't sell it. Don't sell. Keep it for 100 years. You only sell assets. You only sell property that's become impaired, that's no longer useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
When you own a house in Montreal and you move to San Francisco, you sell it because it's not useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
But when you own something you can carry with you your entire life and give to your children and your children's children and your children's children's children, then why would you ever need to sell it? You either generate yield on it by renting it out, or you borrow against it. And if you look at every rich family in New York City, they're rich because they own a city block or a bunch of buildings and their grandfather bought them.
Mm-hmm.
They still have them. And if you ever ask anybody in New York, you're going to sell your apartment or you're going to sell your, like they can't imagine going anywhere else. Everywhere else is down from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere is down. There is no up. And so New Yorkers are kind of a good example because they tend to just get something nice in New York and they hold it forever.
And it appreciates in value.
And if you have something, and if there's 10% more dollars, the price of the something's going up by 10%, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's scarce,
supply and demand, it has to be
right.
High in demand.
Like owning an apartment in the middle of the Midwest off of a country road is probably not scarce.
Mm-hmm.
I can make more of them. But if I own something which is hard to reproduce in a highly desirable place that everybody wants, right, then...
Mm-hmm.
Then you're in good shape. And then, of course, the strategy is I hold it forever. And since I don't sell it, I don't have any tax problem. If you need money, maybe you rent it if it's a rental property. Or if it's not a rental property, you go to the bank and you mortgage it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do some simple math. If the value of the asset goes up 10% a year, then you can borrow 10% loan to value and you can pay 5% interest forever. and get richer.
As long as it keeps going up 10%.
If it's going up, if the asset is appreciating faster than your expense ratio, then you can mortgage it continually forever and get wealthier. And it's kind of a mind-blowing idea. Most people don't get the idea.
It is.
But if you look at people that are big property developers, they get the idea.
You have to have the right asset.
But you have to choose the right asset. You have to choose something that's highly desirable that everybody else is going to want. And so I think that that's the best way to think as an investor. Ask yourself the question, who's buying this thing? Why are they buying it? How long are they going to hold it? And if I ever decide to sell it, who's going to want to buy it from me? Okay. And like with Bitcoin, it doesn't matter where it is. I would want to buy it from you. But if you said, well, I have a yacht, a ship, I have a dojo, I have a building, I have a podcast. There's a small group of people that might buy it from you.
It's a small market. It's a niche market.
So this is like the universal, fungible, highly desirable monetary asset with the biggest brand that's truly global. You can sell it. Another way to look at it is you got $1 million house in Montreal. You want to sell it. It takes you a year. You pay 6% fee and you can sell it to people that want real estate in Montreal. You have $1 million of Bitcoin, you can sell it in 60 seconds to anybody in the world for a 0.1% fee, and it's universally desirable.
Well, Michael, I'm a huge fan of Bitcoin. I'm a big believer. I bought a long time ago. I didn't buy a lot, but I keep buying, you know, everything whatever loose change I have, I buy some more, and I'm a diehard, but I'm also very... you know, critical as well. I want to know the top arguments about Bitcoin. I want to see, is this thing going to crash and burn, or is it going to soar like an eagle? Is it going to fly? And one of the top criticisms I've heard is the greater fool theory. And I know you know it very well, but I'm just going to lay it out there for the listeners who are not familiar with the greater fool theory. There's the greater fool theory basically states that, look, I'm buying Bitcoin at $100 because I think that it's going to go up to 200. And the guy who buys it from me at 200, he thinks it's going to go up to 500. And then somebody buys it at 500 because he thinks it's going to go up to 1,000. And it keeps going up the chain till one day a guy buys it for $1 million, turns around, and there's nobody to buy it for 1.1 million. And he's the greater fool. He's the guy who was left standing with the bag. Everybody made money but him. What's your counter argument to that? Is it a greater fool? Is it a Ponzi scheme, a bubble, so to speak?
Yeah, people that say that or think that way, they don't appreciate the fact that Bitcoin is technology, right? If it wasn't technology, if it was just baseball cards and we're trading them around and there's nothing unique about it, then you start to get in this question of when will somebody not want to buy it? But if you understand it to be technology, it's an energy network, and it's a better energy network than everything it competes with. So for example, like, why would I want to buy a house in Montreal? Why is Montreal there? Because greater fools will, you know, not want to buy in Montreal. Well, Montreal is there because of the river, because of the hydraulics. It's a very favorable geographic location to put a city.
It's unique in some sense.
It's got, you know, if you have lots of energy and if you have lots of water, you can have a city. Well, why don't we just like put our city 1,000 miles north of Montreal? Because we'll freeze and we'll starve to death, and there's no water and there's no energy. There was a fundamental reason why Montreal was there. How about this one? Well, why did the Romans win? Did they just get lucky? Well, no, they had better weapons. They blasted the crap out of the barbarians, you know, from a distance. Why does Brazilian jiu-jitsu work? Just random, greater fools? No, because you have better techniques. How about fire? Is fire a stupid idea? You have a choice of fire or not fire. Fire is a better idea because I can burn the entire field and, you know, or I can take my little hatchet and I can try to chop down the trees, right? So someone that's standing outside is saying, well, I don't think I should use fire to clear a field. I think I should use a rubber hatchet. You're trying to sell me this flame starter thing, and I'll be stuck with the flamethrower until some greater fool comes along. And if no greater fool comes along, fire won't be valuable. How about electricity? I want to sell you an electric power generator or car or steel. Like, steel is material energy. Okay. Is it valuable? Mm-hmm. Is your steel sword valuable?
Of course.
I take my sword, I chop you to pieces, mm-hmm. right? Iron Age, Steel Age. The reason it works is because it's better technology. Your smartphone is better technology. The people that criticize it, typically they have one thing in common. They don't understand the technology and they haven't spent the time to think through, you know, how you would engineer a monetary network.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I could build Bitcoin and I could set up Bitcoin. So instead of 21 million coins, we add 1 million more coins every year. It wouldn't be as good.
It wouldn't be as good at all.
Okay. I could basically set it up so that the rich people could all just vote on whether or not they wanted to change the policy. And maybe we create 100 billion Bitcoin and give it to ourselves. It wouldn't be as good.
Mm-hmm.
I can take away the proof of work network and make it proof of stake. It wouldn't be as good, right? Like, proof of work is everybody shows up to the dojo and they all exercise and it's open and there are some rules, but there's no ruler and people can show up and we all got to compete. And if you show up fat and 50 pounds overweight, you don't win. Proof of stake is I just convert the dojo into like a judo player one. We all have digital avatars in virtual space. And if you had a black belt before, you still have a black belt. And the people that had the 10th degree black belt, they get more fighter points and more agility points. And they always win every battle. And they can sit on a couch eating Doritos and drinking beer. And they still win every battle. And they could also do somersaults because in cyberspace, you don't have to do the work anymore. And so,
you prefer proof of work to proof of stake?
Absolutely.
Really?
Because in proof of work, you have the miners fighting to defend the network for you.
Okay.
They are, when New York wants to shut down Bitcoin mining, they go and they talk to the unions talk to the politicians decide that was a bad idea. And now they like Bitcoin. If you don't have miners in the real world doing real world things, then you get progressively softer, right? And in the Bitcoin environment, the technology gets upgraded every 2 or 3 years. If you don't upgrade your technology, you're not competitive.
Mm-hmm.
You're fat, dumb, and happy, you get squeezed off the network, right? If your energy costs get too expensive, then you're not competitive. You get squeezed off the network. You know, if you get shut down by a politician, you get squeezed off the network. How is this like fighting in real life? In real life, you show up 100 pounds overweight. You don't look both ways. You get slugged in the back of the head. You're sloppy. You're out of shape. Your techniques are poor. You don't keep practicing. Eventually, you're going to lose. By the way, and you're going to age and you're going to lose. So with proof of work, the network is continually replenishing itself, continually redistributing itself. You need these miners to go see the governor of every state and explain why Bitcoin is ethical and good for the world, because you need the governors and the mayors and the senators and the congressmen to defend the network. And they have a vested interest. So yeah, it's just engineered better. So in terms of like, am I worried about the greater fool theory? Well, yeah. If you were to argue against electricity, if I said, hey, I just invented electricity, do you want to put it in your house, your car, your building? Right? You could say, no, you're just trying to sell me some kind of gimmicky thing. I'm going to lose money on it. The answer is no, I'm not trying to sell you a gimmicky thing. I'm giving you electrical energy.
They said that about every innovation. They said that the electricity was useless. They said that the car was useless. It's a fad. The horse will always be there. They said the airplane would be useless. It would be useless in war. They said the telephone would be useless. Nobody would use this thing. They said the computer would be useless. Superior technology, efficient. You know, in fighting, if a move is more efficient, we adopt it. That's one reason why the Brazilians outdid the Japanese. The Japanese were great martial artists. When they taught the Brazilians weren't interested in tradition. Whereas the Japanese, their sensei was unquestionable. He was an authority. If he said, do it this way, you can't question him. Where the Brazilians didn't care which way works better. you know, Elio Gracie was an innovator. He's like, look, I'm going to do whatever works better. I'm going to try and test their techniques. If I find a better way, I'm going to adopt it. Whereas the Japanese are so traditional. If they find a better way, they wouldn't propagate it. Why? Because you think you know you're better than your master. And today in our day and age, the Brazilians always beat the Japanese. Always. Like every time there's a superstar Japanese versus a superstar Brazilian. The Brazilians always win. Why? It's all about what works, what's superior, what's more efficient, what's battlefield tested.
BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, is proof of work. It's an open system. Now, I would say it's like rules without rulers. I mean, there are rules, like you can't bring a gun into the dojo. You can't bring a knife in the dojo. I mean, there are certain things you can't do, right? So there are some rules, but otherwise it's competitive and it's an open system and it's evolving. And when you have a rigid authoritarian system, it's either like a fiat currency where by dictate, this is the right way to do it. Or it's even like a state currency where, you know, the 10 black belts that had all the power, they keep all the power and then all their moves are the moves and nobody else can challenge or you're not allowed to beat them, right? So what you need is a system that is continually replenishing and continually competitive where work matters and you can't just rest on your laurels. And I do think that's why Brazilians defeated all the other. It's not just the Japanese, right? There's a whole set of martial arts. You've got the pretty ones, right? You've got the acrobatic ones, the balletic ones.
Yeah.
And then you've got the ones that are just better. And I think in general, they're all systems, and some systems evolve because they're open and competitive and Darwinian.
Mm-hmm.
And other systems evolve much more slowly, or they don't evolve. And if they're closed, they become fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with the closed system is that that fragility, it doesn't lend itself to organic growth or spread. It won't spread to the world because everybody else is always considering their options. And like if there were no fights, right? If nobody from one school fought the other school, exactly, you wouldn't know which was better.
Exactly.
But the real world, there's fights all the time. And eventually when the real world impinges, the best asset or the best technique or the best technology is going to win. You might not like fire, or you might not like electricity, or you might not like steel, or how about airplanes, right? They will be of no consequence. But at some point when your enemy introduces a superior technology, if you don't adopt the superior technology, they roll over you.
Absolutely.
And nowhere is this more clear than the history of money.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Africans use glass beads. You think glass beads are rare. They're rare for you. But if the Europeans show up and they can stamp out glass beads,
right,
they basically trade you glass beads and they take all your property and you're impoverished. The giant stone coins of the Yap people is not rare. Ultimately, the glass beads were not rare. Pieces of paper are not rare. And so whichever society or group of people has the hardest money, they're going to win the economic war. Just like the group of people that have the hardest, you know, metal. Steel will trump iron. Iron will trump bronze.
It's superior, you know, technology.
Steel from a distance will trump steel from close in. And from above, you will trump, you know, the sky will trump the artillery, right? And it's written in the history of human beings. So I think that's my answer to the greater fool theory, right? You're not a fool if you're adopting technology. 98% of the world doesn't understand. This is the big idea. Everybody gets digital transformation of music and books and maps and communications. They have a hard time dealing with the digital transformation of property, money, or energy. It's like when I show up and I say, you know, all your bonds are digitally transformed. They're all obsolete. That's $100 trillion of them.
Right.
It's kind of hard.
China's making their own digital currency. They say, look, Bitcoin is banned. Use our digital. They're coming out with their own digital currency. What if tomorrow our governments are saying the same thing. Bitcoin is forbidden. Here's our digital currency. You want to go digital? Use our currency. We tax it. We track it. Paper money's gone. Your credit card's debit and this digital app. What will we do then?
Well, you just got to keep, you got to keep in mind that digital currency is not a digital asset or digital property. Correct. So the dollar could be a digital currency and the Bolivar and the CNY can all be digital currencies. Ultimately, the question you got to ask yourself is how much currency do I want to hold versus how much asset or how much property do I want to hold? And ultimately, you'd like to have 99% property, 1% currency. Mm-hmm. The Chinese will move CNY on digital rails, just like the USD will move on digital rails. The USD will spread to 6 billion people. The CNY will spread to 2 billion people. And everything else will be a derivative. And that's an almost certain thing that's going to happen. You're not going to want to hold either of those more than a month. You're going to want to use those for transactions, you know, that are state sponsored or state endorsed. You're going to want to store all the rest of your money in a property or an asset which will hold its value. So digital currency from China doesn't threaten Bitcoin any more than digital currency from the US threatens Bitcoin.
Does it come down to, like Adam Smith would say, look, you have market forces or you have authoritarian forces, and the authoritarian forces always lose. The market force, let the market decide how much apples cost. Let the market decide how much I should pay you for that house. Is it come down that Bitcoin is free? It's unleashed on the world. It's a code. There's nobody controlling it. And hence the market will always, the free market will always be superior to a controlled market like the Chinese market.
I think you can, it is true, the free market, the market will always defeat the controlled centralized system. I think you can see yin and yang here. It's not, the government of Canada is not going to end, and the government of the US is not going to end. As long as there's a Canada and the US and a China, there will be currencies. Mm-hmm. And you can't choose to completely reject the government in those places. In some countries, the government completely collapses. You know, in parts of Africa, Afghanistan, to a certain degree, mm-hmm. you know, it collapses. But for the Western world, you don't have a full system collapse. You could argue like when you dollarize your economy, that's like a system collapse. But in the Western world, or even in China, you won't have a system collapse. You've just got yin and yang. You know, you will have the choice. Do you want to have 100% of your money in the dollar and 0% in Bitcoin? Or do you want 100% in Bitcoin and 0% in the dollar? Or do you want 1% here and 99% there? Mm-hmm. And I think that you'll see the dollar strengthen and spread everywhere in the world. The Chinese are gonna block it. And there'll be 1.5 billion people that'll be behind the Great Firewall of China, and they'll use the Chinese technology stack. And if you're unwise, you'll store your life savings in currencies that lose their value. Mm-hmm. And if you're wise, you'll convert them to property, which is an investment. And if you're really wise, you'll find the best property, the apex property, which in my opinion is Bitcoin. And you know, what you'll see, I think, is, I mean, really wealthy people, you would have all your money in the assets. You would have no money in currencies. Like when you get really wealthy, you have $10 million. You buy a $100 million building. You have $10 million in equity. And you borrow $1 million a year against the $100 million building. And you're in debt. And if you live 100 years, you'll be $110 million in debt, but your building will go up 10% a year, and in 100 years it will double, I don't know, like 15 times. And you'll have tens of billions, a building worth tens of billions of dollars, a little bit of debt, and you will never have held any currency for the long term, right?
I like what you said about yin and yang. I think also Bitcoin would keep the government from making any foolish decisions. Let's say the government comes out with a digital currency. We always have crypto competing with the government's digital currency, and that competition will keep them honest. Because let's say they want to do whatever that's good for them and bad for us. You know, they want to increase the amount of digital currency available. If they want to make it inflationary instead of deflationary, well, we're all going to invest more into Bitcoin. We can cross that border and take our Bitcoin with us. Whereas I can't cross the border and take the government's digital currency with me. There's always going to be some limitation when it comes from governmental forces.
Yeah. As Bitcoin grows, the incentive to be rational grows, right? The incentive for politicians, like the incentive for if your mayor said, we're just going to tax all property in Montreal 10%.
Yeah.
And you can't move it. You can't do anything other than protest.
We have Bitcoin.
Or vote. If you have Bitcoin and then everybody sells all their property and buys Bitcoin and it moves outside of the city, then they're like, well, there's nothing to tax anymore.
Exactly.
So if the country does the same thing, the property moves out. And as more and more of the energy of the civilization moves to Bitcoin, something that you can personally custody outside of gold or property assets that the government can control, that shifts the balance of power to the individual, and it moderates the authoritarian tendencies and the fiat tendencies of governments, and it rewards enlightened rational governments, and it punishes irrational authoritarian governments. And there's something elegant about that.
It is. There is. There's something amazing actually about that. It's just code and it's fair to everybody. And there's no special interest. It's code. You buy it, you own it, it's yours. The government could always pull some strings. You can always, you know, in the Genesis block, the first block of Bitcoin, there was an encrypted message. And it was about the government about to bail the banks again out for the second time.
Chancellor on the
brink. What's that?
Chancellor on the brink.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, the whole thing is they're always messing with our income. You know, they tax us, they bail out the banks, that debases us and it saves them. So I love the fact that Bitcoin it belongs to you. Nobody could take it from you, and you control it. It's more efficient. It's brilliant. It'll keep the governments honest. It's competition in a good way for governments to play ball in the correct fashion. Am I right?
Yeah, we think of it as a universal constant. I think it's the most constant thing, the most reliable, certain thing in the economic universe.
Mm.
Right? That's the brilliance of Bitcoin. It's that we have constructed this decentralized system. And because it is certain, because I can look you in the face and say, I think 100 years from now, there won't be more than 21 million Bitcoin. I think 1,000 years from now, there's no reason why I can't just keep going. I wouldn't promise you that a building will last that long, or a company, or a product, or even a country. I think it'll outlast all those things. You remember what Archimedes said? He said, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I can move the world.
Well,
Bitcoin's the fulcrum. Mm-hmm. It's the spot where you can stand, where you can apply leverage. It's the one certain thing, because you know it's beyond the reach of a CEO, a company, or a government. And if you say, well, what's the lever? Well, like, I'll give you an example. I borrowed $1 billion and I bought Bitcoin with it.
Mm.
That was the lever. What I'm doing is I borrowed $500 million and paid 6% interest to buy Bitcoin, which I think is going to go up more than 6% a year.
Amazing.
Okay. Would I have borrowed that money to buy stocks? No, I wouldn't have borrowed that money to buy house or real estate or land or ships or planes or commodities, because there's nothing else that I'm so certain about. Mm. Because there's nothing else engineered in order to be durable and have integrity for 100 years. So I'm an engineer. And I looked at it and I said, look, electricity, fire, digital energy. I said, Bitcoin is digital energy. It's a first time in the history of the human race. I can take $1 billion of energy or electricity in Montreal, and I can store it for 100 years and spit it out in Tokyo, no power loss. And there's nothing like that. So what could be a better investment than pure digital energy? And that makes it it's just really compelling, right? A really amazing thing. But you got to understand the engineering of it in order to get the conviction around it. Once you understand that, you say, the human race has advanced in epochs, right? what were we before fire? You know, you probably studied paleo theory and studied the theory of human development, right? Before fire, right, we must have had longer digestive tracts and our brains were smaller. And then after fire, we advance. And then what are we, you know, after we master some metals? I mean, like steel. Steel is metallic energy. Build a building 100 stories high with clay and bricks and see how well that works, you know?
Right.
So fire, electricity, nuclear power, you know, most civilizations are based on hydropower. Name a city that's not near a river or a port. If you don't have a river or you don't have a port, you can't form a civilization. Mm-hmm. You'll drown in your toxins, right? We need it for energy. We need it for sanitation. The Romans were the Romans because of aqueducts. Mm-hmm. People don't think about it, but, you know, if you take away water, hydraulic energy, you know, and engineering, then a typical island that holds 100,000 people today couldn't sustain more than 3,000 people, you know, 2,000 years ago. Everybody's just going to die. Right. So you have to master air, fire, water, power, you know, and what is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is digital energy. Is it profound? Well, you know, more profound than the internet, more profound than digital emails or digital books, but they're profound. Look at you and I, we're talking to each other.
Amazing.
Like when, you know, like you and I are Zooming, you know, it's a pretty amazing thing. But the ability to move digital energy between 8 billion people, billions of times an hour, friction free, store it in a container for 1,000 years without power loss. Right? That is the basis for the next level of human development. It's at least as profound as electrical energy.
It's a worldwide ledger and it moves at the speed of light. It's going to, any country that doesn't get behind it, people who don't get behind it, they're going to left behind. They're going to get left behind.
I think that.
Yeah, I agree.
That's why I have passion for it.
Me too as well. You know what? I listen to all your podcasts, man. You got me more convinced than ever. I'm this close to melting down my wife's jewelry and turning it into Bitcoin, liquidating everything and turning everything into Bitcoin.
If she's not wearing it.
Listen, man, I really appreciate you coming onto the channel. I hope we do this again once Bitcoin is over at 100K. I don't think that's going to be too far away. I'm really, really convinced by your arguments. I really appreciate you coming on. I want to be respectful of your time. I could talk to you for another hour easily. But thank you, Michael, for coming down on the channel. The fans are going to love you. And thank you for teaching the MMA world a little bit more about Bitcoin and MMA and crypto. I think are going to go like this. It's going to be a really good fit. And I really, really appreciate you coming on.
Well, right back at you. I really admire everything you're doing. And I admire all the values of the BJJ community. I think they're great values and I appreciate them. I think they're good for the world. And let's put down on our list after 100,000, we'll do round two.
Awesome, man. Can't wait to have you on again. All right, bud. Thank you so much.